Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. In just a moment, we'll be talking about all the week's security news with Adam Boileau, and then we'll head right on into this week's sponsor interview. And this week's show is brought to you by Signal Sciences. Their CEO, Andrew Peterson, will be along in this week's sponsor interview to have a bit of a chat about how a lot of traditional enterprises are running serious business web app shops these days. We talk a bit about one of their customers, a food business, like a food delivery business that delivers tasty treats. They launched an app and it was a surprise hit. Not only is it now responsible for 15% of that company's turnover after only 5 months, but a lot of that is new business. So all of a sudden, web security seems pretty important to them. Andrew says 80% of their new enterprise customers fall into that category, roughly. The, oh God, our digital transformation is actually working category. So he'll be along a little bit later on to talk about some themes around that. But first up, of course, it is time to get into the week's news with our good friend, Insomnia Securities, Adam Boileau. And Adam, old mate Marcus Hutchins, has pleaded guilty to writing and selling banking malware, which there's been a lot of QQ on Twitter about this.
Yeah, there certainly has. There was a lot of people that came out, I guess, in a defense of Marcus back when he got arrested 2 years ago now, something like that. 2017, yeah, August 2017 he was arrested. And yeah, a lot of people were just kind of defending him, I guess. But yeah, he has pled guilty to writing the Kronos banking Trojan, which, you know, was quite a successful piece of malware back in its day. And yeah, that's, you know, he may be facing quite a lot of years in prison, although obviously he's already been in custody for a couple now.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is a funny one. I mean, I'm much more free to speak about the things people were telling me at the time that he was arrested because, you know, defamation law is a thing. Now he has pleaded guilty. I can say that quite a few people had been in touch with me after he was arrested and they were like, yeah, man, this guy was into some serious black hattery. His OPSEC is terrible. A lot of us have known who he is for quite some time. So this whole Marcus Hutchins was innocent thing, I mean, like anyone who was sort of plugged into that malware analysis scene kind of knew that was horseshit.
Yeah, I mean, a lot was made, I guess, of his you know, his work, quote, saving the internet, unquote, from the WannaCry thing, which, you know, it kind of did burn down to, you know, seeing a domain name and a thing, registering to see what happened, and turned out a good thing happened, which was nice for everybody involved, obviously. But yeah, I mean, the fact that someone who was into reversing malware, into talking about malware, had previously been writing malware doesn't seem super surprising, I suppose.
Now, look, as much as I'm prepared to say, yes, I'd heard much about, you know, his involvement in crime, it does seem absolutely clear that he had stopped doing crime. So that is perhaps a mitigating factor when it comes to sentencing. And that's the thing, right? It's a mitigating factor when it comes to sentencing, but people are carrying on like this is a crime that shouldn't have been charged because he's no longer a criminal. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, there's certainly been a lot of column inches in the various comment threads about his story, you know, of people with that kind of opinion, and, you know, a few very sensible people saying, like, this is what the judicial system is for, right, to be able to consider all of the circumstances of a case. You know, someone who's already trying to make amends for things they've done in the past, you know, they will get a different sentence than someone who's actively, you know, involved in doing crime up to the point where they're caught. And, you know, I think he will get some, you know, the judge obviously is going to take into account the fact that he has kind of changed his ways somewhat and is attempting to use his powers for good now. So, yeah, we'll see him, you know, pay his dues. And, he does say himself that, you know, he regrets what he'd done and that he was ready to face the consequences for that. And pleading guilty makes his intent, you know, pretty clear there.
Yeah, well, it also just shows that they had a case, right? So, and then he probably wasn't going to beat the charge. Brian Krebs actually, you know, posted a really solid investigation on Marcus Hutchins some time ago that was, and we spoke about it at the time, that showed that, you know, this guy was most likely involved in malware creation. I asked him for his reaction to Marcus Hutchins' plea, and here's what he said.
On the Hutchins sentencing, you know, based on what I've seen and my interactions with him, I happen to believe he probably is unlikely to go back to writing and selling malware. That said, you know, as somebody who's dedicated a significant portion of his career to chronicling the troubles visited on countless small businesses that are the usual targets of banking malware, like the one that Hutchins admitted to co-authoring and selling, you know, it seems appropriate that he receive more than a slap on the wrist for his actions, because Now, it's easy to overlook the very real and costly damage inflicted by banking Trojans.
It's hard to disagree with that. I mean, I don't want to see the guy go to prison for 10 years. Like, that's not what I'm saying. But, you know, these are actual crimes.
Yeah, exactly, right? And, this, you know, you read, you know, talk to anyone who works in incident response, you know, at a national level, at certs, that kind of thing, right? You do see some, you know, really, or hear some really sad stories about people who have been victimized. And, yeah, these are, you know, these are not people who have any, you know, who deserve to be victimized at all, right? And seeing, you know, people who facilitate that, you know, especially the nerds that don't really think through the consequences of their actions, you know, as opposed to actual criminals who say, you know, well, we're going to do crime and that's just our, you know, our choice in life, as opposed to, you know, poorly adjusted nerds who maybe don't see through the full set of consequences. It's, you know, it's important that they do see that, I think.
Well, I think Peter Fillmore won Twitter with his take on this. Which is, the whole internet loves Malware Shake Duck, a lovely duck that saved the internet. 12 months later, we regret to inform you that the duck was the author of malware that stole your grandmother's life savings. Very well done, Peter Fillmore. That was a good tweet. Would read again. Would like again. Would retweet again. Now, look, of course, the big story of the last week, the funny story of the last week, is APT-34 having kind of a bad time. This is an Iranian crew, otherwise known as Oil Rig. They're getting shadow brokered. They're getting their tools dropped on Telegram channels, like, you know, all of their ops blown. It's pretty funny when it's not you,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly, yes. Yeah, somebody, either an insider or an outside agent of some sort, appears to have infiltrated this Iranian government hacker crew, apparently owned a bunch of their boxes and, like, RM'd them. There were some screenshots floating around of, you know, purported, you know, kind of boot screens, you know, boot sectors that have been overwritten on the boxes with, you know, messages saying that you've been hacked and all your stuff deleted. And then, yeah, their tools and techniques and a bunch of, you know, command and control information domains and IP addresses and even names and things have been being dropped in a Telegram channel and then kind of, you know, distributed around the internet for everyone to have a look at. I mean, some of the malware researchers are having a bit of a field day. And, yeah, real bad time if you happen to be working in that particular Iranian crew.
I spoke to Grok about this, and, you know, the funny thing is here, they're claiming to be an insider very much like shadow brokers, but they're speaking in broken Farsi. And according to Grok, like, the Iranian teams tend to be pretty small. There'll be like six people. So the idea that, like, it's one of those insiders, like, just doing this undetected and, you know, has not been strung up yet is just hogwash. Here's Grok's take on that.
The odds of someone being able to quit and no one knowing who it is, it's literally impossible. They certainly wouldn't survive for a month. So this has to be someone who is not in Iran, which leaves someone who would want to fight Iran at the infowar level. And basically, that doesn't leave very, very many options. So it's got to be someone in the GCC area. What's very, very interesting about this is sort of the cyber conflict that has been going on is evolving more and more towards what we used to see back in the heyday of the hacker groups. And if things keep going this way, I think we can start to expect some ZFO-style zines to come out, which will be very exciting. You know, all that ASCII art can finally get put to use again. So there's a bright future ahead for this conflict.
That was the Grok stealing my Twitter jokes there. But yes, you know, when will SIGINT agencies start publishing zines and which nation state actors will produce the best defacement art and smack talk was my question on this one. But I mean, you know, we've commented on this a few times, like I think as recently as like a week or two ago about how the interaction between nations at this level really does look like hacker wars, right?
Well, exactly right. I mean, the intelligence agencies and the military, like, they stole our hobby and turned it into, you know, international war. So it makes sense that they would, you know, adopt the style of our zines and our jokes. And, you know, the Twitter joke that you made, you said that DPRK was winning in the art department on the basis of their Sony defacement when they owned all the boxes inside Sony Pictures Entertainment.
Yeah, the hacked by GOP skeleton was pretty good.
Yeah, which, I mean, is exactly as we said at the time, like ripped from, you know, someone being told to make it look like a, you know, 90s hacker crew. So yeah, I think Grok's onto something. We've totally got a bright future here of sweet lols.
Russia false flagging Islamic State against TV5 Mondo. What a terrible effort. Like I posted a screen cap from that one as well because it was just, Russia, you got to lift your art game. You really
yeah,
do.
Yeah, definitely. Haven't North seen Korea's that. Got you beat.
That's it. You've got to worry when you're lagging. You know, we cannot allow there to be an artwork gap. Just think of it that way. Now, Cisco Talos has been doing some great research. They've got a post up about a crew. They're calling this campaign Sea Turtle. This is very similar to the DNS espionage stuff, but it's a different crew. And it turns out there's been two groups running these types of campaigns. I spoke to Craig Williams from Talos, and yeah, he was happy to affirm that we are talking about multiple groups up to DNS fiddling. Here's what he said.
We were definitively able to say there are at least two different actors operating, you know, in the Middle East and North Africa doing redirection campaigns. And one of them was significantly more advanced than the other, right? And what we saw was a very stealthy way of redirecting domains so that, you know, the attacker could effectively man the middle, the actual primary target, and collect information to help them carry out espionage activities. Really what the attacker would do is, you know, use a couple different techniques, including just simple things like spear phishing or exploiting a server with, you know, a public exploit in order to get access. You know, once they got access to that initial server, they would get credentials. They would take those credentials and use them to access the registry via the compromised credentials. They would then update where that domain was supposed to point. They would actually, you know, direct the lookup to their server, which of course completely resembled the target server, and they would harvest credentials. You know, as they got credentials, they could then go back to the actual primary target and take the real SSL certificates and implant them on their server, making it virtually impossible to detect from a third-party perspective.
Now, it's that last step there that is very interesting to me because, you know, when we've spoken about the DNS espionage campaign in the past, they were using like free DV certs from like Let's Encrypt and whatever to get things to not send out alarms. What Craig's telling us is happening in this Sea Turtle campaign is they're using the first stage harvested creds to actually get into the servers and steal the legit like keys and SSL certificates from those boxes. And that's going to be hard to detect, right, once they've got that up and running.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly illustrates that there is still some real value in certificate transparency and picking up that kind of first step where you've got the initial certificate being issued. But yeah, moving back to the legitimate cert that you've stolen makes so much sense. Kind of minimizes the amount of things that can go wrong with the rest of the Man in the Middle campaign. Yeah, and totally a smart move. I don't know that I'm surprised that there's, you know, multiple groups operating in the DNS infrastructure, you know, in the same environment. It makes sense, you know, that there's only one DNS, and it's a great place to go about doing computer hacking. So yeah, the fact there's more than one group there is not really a surprise. I mean, I think something that is interesting here is that, you know, historically, I think DNS has been avoided because there is only one and it is watched quite well. I mean, with, you know, the historical DNS records.
Apparently not, Adam.
Well, no, I mean, you know, people have been using DNS for bad things for a long time. But once you start doing that, then, you know, there are a lot of eyes on the DNS and you can really start to pull the threads backwards. And it's, you know, from an OPSEC point of view, it's a lot thornier than, you know, many other places. And that's, I guess, what certificate transparency aimed to introduce into the certificate world was the same idea of, you know, having a global ledger that we can use to I said global ledger, didn't I? Oh, dear. We're not talking about Bitcoin anymore. Having some kind of global ledgers where you can track everything, does make it more difficult to keep your OPSEC tight. And yeah, the fact that this particular campaign carried on, despite the fact that they knew people was watching, you know, I guess suggests a level of motivation and, you know, being under orders that perhaps differentiates it from more casual crews.
Well, it's also the fact that a lot of state-sponsored crews out there don't care if they're uncovered, right? Because they're not going to get extradited. They've got protection. They've got the protection of a state. Talos is also, one thing they're predicting is we're going to see a lot more of this because once this stuff hits the news, you typically see copycats and other people going, huh, that's a good idea, and jumping on in. They've also got some further information up on the DNS espionage crew.
Yeah, there's been some updates. That crew has been changing its behavior a little bit following some of the publicity they've made their malware that they're dropping a little bit more context aware about where it's going to try and make sure they're only dropping it in the place that they're looking for. There's a new set of tooling they're using, which I think Cisco Talos are calling the Kharkov malware, Kharkov Trojan, that's being used and being dropped by this particular team. But yeah, some more interesting details, some more IOCs being dropped about that particular actor, which is the kind of, you know, the less professional one in the DNS in the region that Cisco Talos will be talking about.
Now, you actually spotted something in this Talos write-up about DN espionage that I don't think anyone else has put together yet. It was a great pickup. Please tell us what it is.
So in the IOCs that Talos provided, they had a bunch of IP addresses and domain names that were involved in running C2 and using that to link between the new Kharkov malware and the previous DN espionage campaign. They were looking at ways that tied together. Anyway, one of the domains that was in that list is hr-wepro.com. And those of you who may remember the news a week or two ago now, Wepro is the big Indian outsource provider that got well and truly owned by a bunch of Carters. So,
yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, and Brian Krebs has got more details on that. Is HR-Wepro an actual Wepro domain, though, or is it just like one that looks like a Wepro domain?
I mean, I imagine it's just one that looks like a Wepro domain, but HR is a great aspect to fish people from. You know, everyone wants to fill in their HR forms and get their TPS reports with the new cover sheets, and it's a great way to collect creds and own people.
It is. And there is some more detail here from Krebs on the gift card scams that people are owning Wepro to try to use that trusted access to then own Wepro's customers so they can sort of blend in the traffic there and, you know, do their gift card fraud. But, yeah, Brian's been giving them a hard time over the last week. Couple of stories.
Yeah, I mean, this is another great example of using historical DNS records to tie together a previous campaign. So Brian used the IP addresses we saw from the previous campaign against Wepro and then pulled DNS records to see what else had pointed there over time. And, yeah, there's a bunch of other customers targets of this particular crew over time. And then Brian's been through that, reached out to a few of the companies and got some confirmations from them that they – you know, they noticed an intrusion, but then totally took care of it and nothing bad happened and everything's totally fine.
They were evicted. Real easy. Done.
Yeah, exactly. No problems at all. But yeah, there's certainly some names in there that, you know, might raise some eyes. Capgemini, the consultancy firm out of France. There's also an Expedia group does travel. I didn't see any comment from them in Brian's article. But yeah, it looks like a bunch of people getting a bunch of own and, you know, I guess having their gift cards stolen.
Yeah, we got two ransomware stories here, but I mean, it's not really clear from reading either one of these. I would like to know whether or not this was a targeted attack in which, you know, people gained access to the network somehow and then deployed some ransomware, or whether or not this was garden variety regular ransomware that arrives by email, because that stuff did drop off for a long time, which makes me wonder, you know, whether this is, you know, targeted or just mass spammed ransomware. The first one, though, is, I guess, pretty high impact for lovers of the Weather Channel, because they actually went off air for 90 minutes while they were, like, restoring their systems from backup. So it looks like, you know, that one at least had a happy ending, although not if you happen to be tuned in for those 90 minutes because you really needed to know what the weather was going to be. And the other one was a manufacturing giant called AB Schmidt. But yeah, a little bit light on details here.
Yeah, maybe the mass market, you know, non-targeted stuff, you know, has dropped off. And so we are only seeing the dregs of it, which, of course, doesn't get a whole bunch of details. And you'd think that if there was an opportunity to claim, oh, it was targeted, then you would see companies doing that if they could. But yeah, I don't know, you know, whether there is, you know, someone picking up it again. Maybe another crew has picked it up and run with it because, I mean, you don't have to get very many targets to make good money. Mostly, I think in this story, I was impressed that, you know, they managed to restore from backups in 90 minutes. Like,
yeah,
that's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, you know, you got your shit together there. Well done.
Yeah.
Ah, Huawei news. It's the Huawei section of the show. It looks like the United Kingdom is going to allow Huawei to contribute certain bits to its 5G build. We're talking things like antennas. They describe these components as like being non-core, even though that's not really a thing in 5G. But you get the idea that they're going to use just some bits and pieces here.
Yeah, I mean, you could imagine them making an argument that, say, passive components like, you know, antennas or waveguides or things that are unmanaged, you know, would be a thing you could safely use. Although the extent to which anything these days is unmanaged, and people seem to be bunging IoT interfaces into, you know, literally everything that doesn't need it. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, an antenna had an Ethernet port these days. But yeah, you could see them making an argument about that. Although they don't say like strictly passive, like non-core components. You could, you know, maybe means more than that. I'm not quite clear, but it is certainly being reported in the more mainstream press as, you know, Britain kind of breaking from the Five Eyes a little bit. But then again, this, you know, conversation about it was being had at a meeting of Five Eyes partners, and it does look like there is some kind of you know, agreement to respect the other people's positions in amongst the Five Eyes themselves.
Well, that's it. There's a Five Eyes powwow happening in Glasgow right now. Representatives from all of those five countries, SIGINT agencies are there, and they're sort of downplaying the extent of the disagreement over this and saying, oh, we're all still friends. But I'm guessing, you know, behind the scenes, maybe at, you know, more diplomatic levels, there's a lot more conflict over this.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine there's still, I mean, none of the core argument has gone away. There's just, you know, they need to come up with some kind of agreement that everyone in the, you know, in the partnership is going to agree to. And clearly Britain is pretty keen on having a cheap 5G network and not necessarily national security.
Yeah, and there's been some news reports going around over the last week too that the CIA has been briefing people on Huawei stuff and you know, claiming to have the goods that they are, you know, funded by the military and intelligence apparatus of the Chinese government. So, I mean, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we've said on the show a few times that the US, you know, the intelligence agencies probably wouldn't be going, you know, pushing this hard if they didn't actually have some real reason to do it. And we haven't seen it yet. But yeah, the fact that we're seeing some things beginning to come out of the intelligence world in the US that is making it out into the public, you know, I think maybe is a sign of where this is going to go.
The French government has come up with its own like messenger app so that their politicians won't use WhatsApp and Telegram. Didn't get off to a great start, though.
Oh, dear. Yeah, they rolled out their own kind of implementation of the Riot chat system, which is an open source project. The intent was that you'd be able to sign up to it if you're a French government, you know, user, internal government user, and use that instead of, you know, WhatsApp or other things so they can keep more control of their comms, which, you know, you can kind of see that making sense. Yeah, unfortunately, they rolled out with a bug in the registration system that did the restriction based on your email address. And, yeah, you could bypass it if you put, like, @ in your username so that it would pass one to be your email address and use that to bypass the validation. And, yeah, just not exactly what you're looking for in a secure government comm system.
No, but, I mean, you know, we've got politicians here in Australia using WeChat. You know, like, because there's a lot of Chinese people in Australia. There's a lot of, like, you know, Australian-born Chinese as well, and a lot of them use WeChat. And I don't know, I kind of feel like, this is balkanization that might make a bit of sense. Then again, I mean, you could just use Signal.
Well, exactly right. And that's, you know, there may be some advantages to that over Riot. I mean, having a system that is run, you know, where you run all of your own infrastructure rather than relying on Signal to provide at least some of the meeting, you know, matchmaking and address book and meeting stuff, you know, I could see why you do that. Although, interestingly, the Riot software packages uses the Matrix protocol, and Matrix.org actually got themselves owned just recently as well, and where someone was on the bridge from their network into, you know, other chat systems and sniffing messages and all sorts of bad things were going on. So, you know, it may not be the panacea that they hoped for.
Yeah. Congress has sent off a letter to Google asking for details on the so-called Sensor Vault. This is, you know, Google's massive repository of where all of their customers have been. Now, this is, you know, a feature that beacons back customer location that is turned off by default. But it's like, you know, there's so many myriad ways to accidentally opt in to this type of collection. This is kind of why I found that Utah law very interesting, that said that police would need to get warrants for data held by third parties, data like this, right? And I sort of feel like this is a law that we need in places other than Utah. and it looks like Congress is looking at this because it is a little bit alarming. But this is interesting, right?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, if you've ever looked at your Google location history in your Google account, yeah, it does get a little bit creepy when you realize that just because you wanted to get, you know, directions once, or you wanted to get, you know, local pizza recommendations once, that you've ended up accidentally opting into, you know, a global corporate panopticon, which probably wasn't what you intended. I think, yeah, Congress obviously asking some questions about exactly, you know, how much data Google has got, who they're sharing it with, in what circumstances, all that kind of thing does seem like a, you know, a useful function of government in regulating the corporate marketplace.
Yeah. Now we got some more details on the CCleaner and ASUS crew behind those supply chain hacks. And it looks like they got into some, like, you know, third-rate game companies and were doing a bit of supply chain infiltration there. Is that right?
Yeah, so the story here goes that at least a couple of game companies, I think one was the one that they mentioned by name was in Thailand, were producing games that were for their downstream customers that were compromised. And the vector for that in the supply chain was that this attacker had distributed or trojaned in place copies of the Microsoft Visual Studio compiler to introduce that link time malware into the things being built, which is pretty cool. It's not clear whether or not they broke into the actual game companies themselves or whether they were, distributing pirated copies the company was downloading pirated copies of Microsoft Visual Studio that had been pre-trojaned by this actor. But
well, we did see that with Xcode, remember? Like Apple's development kit. China, we saw a Trojan version that was pretty popular on the torrents because people couldn't be bothered jumping through the hoops to get the official Apple one from the Apple websites, and it was trojaned. But this stuff is cool, isn't it? Like Subverter compilers. I mean, as Robert De Niro said in Ronin, nice, my kind of job.
Nice, my kind of job.
Yeah, and I mean, it's the classic computer Trojan. Remember, right back to Kernighan and Ritchie, kind of demonstrating this back in the, I guess, in the 70s now. It's the classic thing to do is to backdoor the compiler to produce backdoored code that then backdoors compilers, which that's very satisfying from a computer science, security perspective.
FireEye scored a win this week. This is pretty funny, actually. They noticed that the source code of Carbonac had actually been uploaded to VirusTotal like 2 years ago. And how does that even happen? I do not know. But someone accidentally uploaded like raw archives of the Carbonac source code from a Russian IP. And that's embarrassing.
That is. Can you imagine that poor Russian just kind of smacking his face palm and going, oh, God. Yeah. What if it's Russian for
I mean, that's this is the Fin7 crew. I mean, they're serious business. They've stolen like €1 billion.
Yeah, although they did get rolled up, at least a couple of the people in that crew got rolled up. And, of course, the malware has lived on, outlived the original crew. There's a bunch of other groups also using Carbonac. So it's, still quite a relevant set of tooling for people to go and look at. And, I imagine the FireEye researchers who found it lying around must be quite enjoying, having, the banking malware, financial trojans and stuff without actually having to reverse it. So that's luxury.
Yeah, I think the OG Fin7 people are all gone, but there's, Fin7 next generation sort of carrying the torch onwards. But hectic. Someone's just going around guessing Ethereum keys and getting paid. What? Tell me about this story. How does that work?
Oh, dear. Yeah, so this particular researcher had been rummaging around in the Ethereum blockchain, thinking about ways to steal money, as you do, and thought, well, maybe I'll try, Ethereum private keys that are, truncated or are strange, weird values, either by user choice or through bad software. And he started looking for Ethereum wallets whose private key was just straightforward one. Anyway, turns out there were some wallets that were like that, and they'd all been cleaned out by somebody else. So he incremented two, same thing, incremented three, same thing, incremented the next several billion options for, the kind of simple private keys. Yeah, turns out someone's been through and nicked something like 40,000 Ether, which, somewhere between $50 and, $3, depending on what time of the day it is. But someone's already been through and nicked a whole bunch of money already.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because there's also that news doing the rounds this week that like the most common password or something is like 12345. And, cue the Spaceballs jokes, right? Like, that's the sort of combination an idiot has on his luggage, right?
yep, well.
But it looks like same thing for Ethereum. But, I can imagine there's quite a few wallets with like just, because some of those crypto clients are just terrible, right? So they're going to be using some pretty shoddy code that might even just be accidentally assigning common values to a lot of those wallets.
I think that's a reasonable root cause for a bunch of the stuff is that there's just bad software somewhere along the chain when someone generated their keys. And we've certainly seen people using other key generation schemes like the Brain wallets that use a password to derive the key material, and then people cause brute dictionary attack those and stole a bunch of money as well. We've seen that kind of thing going on.
A dark web market, the Wall Street Market, has exit scammed to the tune of something like $14.2 million. No, I mean, look, full credit to them. This is smart. Like Dream Market announced that they were going to disappear. There's been a whole bunch of arrests. And they're thinking, and I think Catalin Campano, who wrote this story, points out that they're probably thinking, we're going to get a lot of their users moving over to our platform. That's going to draw a lot of heat. How much is in escrow? $14 million. Okay, peace out. We're gone. I think it's very sensible.
Yeah, no, it does. It makes a lot of sense when you line all the pieces up like that. It seems like a rational kind of thing to go to rather than...
Well, and as you often say, like, this is the business model for the dark web, which is exit scam before you get arrested, right? So...
Yeah, I mean, actually, I did like in this case, there's a bunch of the like people who didn't necessarily exit scam, like not the people who ran off with the money, but who had some degree of privilege in the marketplace, like, you know, moderators and various other flunkies who are, have also realized that they may as well cash out now while they can. And we've seen people sending out messages to the users of the market saying, hey, we've got your location information or your addresses from your orders, we're going to give that to the, you know, dump that for the authorities if you don't send us half a Bitcoin or whatever, you know, whatever amount of money they were trying to scam for. So sort of, you know, secondary scamming from the moderators and other people who have access to the back end.
Ah, the dark web. The dark web, it's not what it used to be. Actually, it is what it always
it's
has
totally
been.
100% what it used to be.
Yeah. Now, look, the FBI has pumped out some interesting numbers here. They say that U.S. companies lost $1.3 billion just in 2018 due to business email compromise scams. I mean, it's unbelievable the types of scamming that we are seeing here. I think I mentioned, I think it was last year that there was some... there was some crew targeting property settlements here in Australia, and that, you know, hit the news pretty much big time. But yeah, wow, $1.3 billion—that's a lot of dollars.
That certainly is, and I mean, it really goes to show that we're going to see the crime, you know, move to where it's super effective. I mean, you know, ransomware at bulk for, you know, users who can only afford a couple hundred dollars to pay off their thing versus, you know, a little bit more targeting, a little bit more time spent, you know, getting your email templates right. And all of a sudden you can, you know, scam very real money in the case of property transfers, you know, a lot in one go. It becomes, you know, a much more targeted process, but probably overall, you know, more lucrative. And, you know, these numbers certainly, you know, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's crazy how much money you can make doing that stuff. Still, though, and I know it's not business email compromise, but it's just one of my favorite examples of an Australian criminal. And I've mentioned it on the show before, but it's the guy who was sending invoices to BHP and Rio Tinto, like huge mining companies, for full page ads in magazines that didn't exist. And they were paying them for years before he got caught. But he did get caught and he went to prison. So sucks to be him. Got some interesting research here relating to being able to extract protected material, like, you know, crypto keys and stuff from Qualcomm chips. This type of research is going to become more and more important. I believe this affects a whole bunch of affected, because it's been fixed, but it affected a whole bunch of chipsets used on Android phones for their sort of trusted compute function.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of research into the secure enclaves, you know, on Apple hardware and on the sorts of hardware you find in Android phones, you know, is a thing that a lot of people are focusing on, you know, at the kind of high end of the research area, just because, you know, these are very important parts of the trusted chain, you know, in devices that have untrusted code in the case of mobile phones, but do have to have, you know, a place to store their secrets. The research here was looking into, I think, a kind of side channels, cache-based, timing-based side channels from the main CPU towards the trusted execution environment, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, you can, you know, a lot of attacks that are totally not viable or are just, you know, super difficult to pull off, you know, across the network or remotely, you know, because of the timing jitter, are absolutely viable when you're so close to the hardware, but when you're on the CPU where, you know, the execution environment, the trusted execution environment is, you know, right next to you on the same die in some cases, then yeah, you have a lot of options that you don't have elsewhere. And that seems to be what this research is doing. You know, leaking a few bits of information out of it is then enough to go and hone in on. In this case, they were pulling out ECDSA crypto keys from the enclave. So yeah, really cool research.
Yeah. This one is a really classic bug in EA's Origin client. Like, this is like, it's a bad bug and it affects, they have so many users, EA, the game company, of course. But yeah, tell us about this one.
Yeah, so this is a bug via the URI handler installed by the Origin, you know, Windows Origin desktop kind of game store, game launcher client that they use to run, you know, a whole bunch of really, you know, very popular games. It installs a URL handler in your browser for the Origin Origin:// URI scheme, and then the actual Origin application itself is Angular kind of client side JavaScript web tech stuff. And this is a bug in, you know, kind of, it's basically kind of cross site scripting, but an Angular leads code exec, and then from there you can call onwards into the real, you know, operating system and run arbitrary code. So yeah, if you click on a or you happen to be hit by this where it's triggered by some other more automated mechanism, then yeah, straight up remote code exec on gamer's desktop, which is
single click PowerShell everything, right? It's pretty cool.
That's bad.
Duo Security runs its own little publication called Decipher. Some excellent journalists work there. One of them is Fahmida Rashid. And she's just written up a little write-up of some research here that really looks at the way that various security endpoint agents like fight with each other once they're installed on a typical enterprise box. And it finds that some of them can wind up so resource-starved that they just stop working. And we're talking about things like patch management software, like important stuff. And I just think this is this should be getting more attention.
Yeah, now this is a really interesting kind of write-up for people to read, especially in enterprise environments where the temptation to have, you know, 47 different endpoint agents installed for various bits of the, you know, the software they have to run just results in systems that are, you know, thoroughly unusable. You know, take 40 minutes to boot or whatever. It's not, you know, I've certainly seen that in a bank environment. Such a terrible plan. But yeah, this is based on some research that looked into, you know, the footprint of agent components installed on endpoints and, you know, what percentage of them were working at any point in time, what percentage of them were up to date and functioning and doing what they were supposed to, and yeah, the sort of the relationships between them, you know, where they conflict on port network ports they're meant to be listening on, or, you know, other resources that are contended, and the net result being that, you know, you end up with systems that, you know, aren't patched, or where the AV doesn't work, or where the remote management you know, doesn't function, or, you know, or worse, exposes you to compromise. And that's, you know, certainly
bad.
If I saw a box with,
yeah, but you know, the company did this research is called Absolute Software. I've never heard of them before, but they claim to have drawn this data from 6 million devices over 1 year, looking at 12,000 organizations that are based in North America and Europe. But you know, you just mentioned the key takeaways, but the percentages here are awful, right? So they say that 21% of endpoints were missing anti-malware protection because the agents were outdated or otherwise not working. And 23% of the patching tools designed to remediate vulnerabilities in devices and software were broken or disabled.
I wish I was surprised.
I am surprised by this. You're not? You look at those numbers and you're like, huh, par for the course?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the number that jumped out for me from this was the average enterprise endpoint has 10 different agents installed on it. And that to me seems, you know, I would have guessed more than 10 from the sorts of systems that we see. I mean, I'm not surprised. I mean, agent software is, you know, if you're on a, you know, on a red team gig, you're on a pen test or something, and you see a Windows box that's got, you know, just Windows domain stuff on it and no other agents, you're like, oh, okay, now I've got to find some Windows OD. That sucks. If you see a box that's got 10 agents on it, you're like, all right, party time, I'm going to have RCE by lunchtime, you know. And all of these things that are, I mean, a lot of them are there for security reasons. And, you know, we just look at them and go, hey, target-rich environment, good times. You know, privileged software runs in a privileged context. It's going to be badly maintained. It's going to work poorly. And, yeah, we expect to get, you know, auth bypass or SQL injection or remote code exec in those things. And, yeah. Yeah, I'm not surprised.
But wouldn't it suck for you if you came up with some tasty ode for one of their crappy bits of enterprise software, but it was like that Mr. Burns situation where he had so many diseases that were all competing that he didn't get sick? You know, like you come up with your payload, you fire it off at the box and the agent's unresponsive. Sucks to be you, red team guy.
No, honest to God, it has absolutely happened where, you know, you would have got a shell if only the damn thing worked. Like the actual product worked like it was supposed to and was actually functional, then yes. Honestly, that happens. I mean, I'm not going to say every week around the office, but it's a pretty common complaint.
Now, we've got two skateboarding dogs this week, Adam. Two of them. The first one, of course, is the Emojency. Now, this is an unverified viral tweet, but it looks legit. Please tell us what it is.
Mr. Chaos Prime on Twitter reports that he saw an engineering department lose a full day's worth of work because somebody put an emoji in a Git commit message, and then somewhere in the downstream, the Atlassian Bamboo server that was processing it choked and ruined their entire Git tree, and they had to rebase master, and terrible things happened.
Yeah. And funnily enough, they claimed that it was the facepalm emoji, and they say they can't see how that could have been improved upon. Which I think
it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Now, look. Finally, God, how do you introduce this one? Lime scooters. They're like those, you know, battery powered scooters that you use an app to unlock them and ride them around and stuff. They're a thing in Brisbane. Someone has owned a bunch of them, and they're just spouting off really sort of smutty messages out of the speakers on them when people unlock them. And, you know, Lime have taken like 8 of these scooters off the streets of Brisbane because they're sort of yelling, you know, sexually suggestive stuff at the people who are, who are trying to ride them around.
Oh, dear. Yeah, no, Lime scooters you know, are all over the place. We have them here in New Zealand. Of course, you know, scooting is also a big thing in the Silicon Valleys, I understand. But, yeah, these things are, you know, being IoT-connected garbage, of course, are going to get owned. The question I had, of course, seeing this particular story out of Brisbane is, like, it's got to be someone you and I know.
It
like,
has to be, right?
It has to be. Like, no one's going to do it in the town they don't live in, right? Because it's only funny if you are there to see it. And there was a talk at KiwiCon a year ago about how to hack Lime scooters amongst other types of
IoT garbage. So what you're saying is this is your fault. Like I would think this was funnier if that, like, there's some sort of, you know, fairly racist elements to the audio that they're putting in these things that I wouldn't want to repeat, but I mean if they hadn't ruined it with that, this could be a lot funnier.
Yeah, like if Filzy did it, right, it'd be duck noises and stuff and it would be hilarious. But clearly it wasn't Filzy. At least I'm assuming it wasn't Filzy. And, you know, that would be hilarious. But sadly, yeah, it's unfortunate that people do have to ruin the lulls with terrible messages.
Yeah, that's it. Well, Adam, that's it for this week's news. Thank you very much for joining us. And we're going to do it all again next Wednesday.
Yes, and then everything will be terrible once more and we can laugh again. Good times.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. This week's sponsor is Signal Sciences. They make web security software. I guess you'd call it a next generation WAF. A lot of people have had success with Signal Sciences software because it's, you know, it's largely set and forget. Something like 95% of their customers run the software in full blocking mode out of the box with no drama. So that's nice because babysitting a WAF really sucks and makes you hate life. You can run it inline or you can run it on your web servers. Andrew Peterson is a co-founder of Signal Sciences and serves as its CEO. He joined me to talk about the indisputable fact that many enterprises are finding themselves running critical web applications they weren't running a year ago. Digital transformation is a pretty clear path to profit these days. So that's putting people in interesting positions. I started off by asking Andrew what percentage of their customers are traditional enterprises who've pushed critical web apps recently, and here's what he had to say.
I'd say, especially for our enterprise customers, it is a high percentage of those customers. So probably 80% of our enterprise customers are coming from a business where they're not a software company and have outsourced most of their software development in the past. And so like now it's like the last 5 years, not only are they building their own software teams in-house, it's really becoming a driver of the future of their business. And that's what the sort of transformation means for them, right? Is that it's not just sort of a technology transformation. It's really a business transformation for them. And recognizing how that then has an implication for security, I think has been interesting to talk to the security professionals in these types of companies that we're working with.
Now, when we initially sat down to sort of talk about what we're going to talk about, which is, you know, something that we often do here on Risky Biz, you know, you cited a pretty interesting example. One of your clients was a, you know, sort of takeaway food / delivery type of company, and they built a website and an app to allow people to order their food. And, you know, it's just one of those little projects that sort of kicked along. And then all of a sudden that accounted for something like, what, 15, 20% of their business. And all of a sudden they had to suddenly care about security. I mean, that seems to be a fairly typical experience for businesses like that in 2019.
I mean, what's interesting, again, like, it's not like it's the first time they had a website. This is a business that's been around for 30 years. And, you know, they had outsourced building of a website and a mobile application in the past. And they, you know, they had a new project where they said, hey, we're going to try to do something that makes it a very digitally native experience, whatever that actually means, right? It's just something that they're really trying to make a experience that's about buying their food, but using a unique technology experience for them to do that. And it wasn't that, you know, it's not only that it's sort of become a bigger part of their business. Yeah, it's about 15% of their business, and they launched it, you know, 5 months ago. So that has been pretty dramatic in terms of what the focus of their business is. But the customers that they're able to engage with and that they're actually gaining that are using that service are a lot of them are new customers for them.
Yeah. So they're growing their business that way.
they're growing their business that way. They're then able to.
Isn't it funny when one of marketing's lame ideas kind of hits? Because it sounds like this is one of those examples, right? Like,
you know, from a marketing perspective, you're trying stuff all the time to try to reach new customers, and some of them are harebrained ideas that don't work out at all, and some actually work. Just seems like
you don't expect an initiative like that, especially when it's, you know, couched in that sort of language of, you know, that sort of, you know, digital experience. We're going to build a digital experience so people can order this food, right? You don't expect that to become 15% of your business within 5 months and a lot of that to be new business. I mean, that is, you know, and that's when you're going to start feeling a little bit nervous about things like denial of service conditions, downtime, credential stuffing, all of the sort of stuff that you guys kind of deal with, right?
Right. Well, I mean, on the one side, right, on the business side, they get really excited. But then the security folks that are in-house, you know, it's a very common story also even with cloud, where security was like, look, people are adopting cloud. Okay, everybody goes through fads or different types of projects. But the moment that those projects get really serious and start having an impact on the business, and the security person is basically saying, shoot, now I got to catch up, you know, now I got to play catch up.
This marketing thing that was supposed to be a joke is all of a sudden a critical application.
Right. And so, you know, the story that it's about, you know, a consumer, you know, food brand, that same story, we've just heard it kind of over and over across lots of different of these industries where, you know, again, they're just not technology companies, but that initiative is really having an impact on that driver of new business growth for them. And it's leaving IT, you know, in a position where they're like, hey, we actually have a win here, but it's leaving security kind of holding the bag to say, okay, security, now go figure out what we do to secure this new thing.
I feel like there's one vertical which has always kind of understood this, and that's banking. And I think last time you and I spoke, I mentioned that I think around 2001, 2002, I interviewed the head of group security for Commonwealth Bank here in Australia. I mean, a big company. That was a man by the name of John Gertz, who I think was ex-AFP. And I just remember this one conversation we had back then. And I think digital security was kind of within his remit back then, right? Because this is before they had big security teams and whatever. And he just said, look, the thing you got to realize is that banks, we are security companies. Like, the whole pitch of value to deposit holders, you know, back in the day was give us your money and we'll keep it safe, right? And now that money is largely, you know, recorded and transferred digitally. Guess what? That's our job. So that's the sort of thinking that I guess now is bleeding into other industries. Like, you wouldn't have expected a food delivery company to get to the position where they're like, well, actually, you know, we're a technology company that delivers delicious treats, right? But that's essentially 15% of their business now.
Totally. Well, the other example I use there is that it's not just these kind of like other types of companies that aren't technology companies. Like, I really like using Intuit as an example here as well. Intuit, you know, software company, technology company, they've been focused on this. You know, this is a good example of someone that's in that finance industry, like you were talking about. They're really leading the way when it comes to DevSecOps. But if you think about, you know, what that business looked like 5 years ago, you installed that software on your laptop. It's a box top software that you'd install there, and so, you know, the types of security vectors that they're really worried about, they weren't worried so much about their websites because that wasn't getting that much access. Now, fast forward to now, I wouldn't be surprised if you told me that the majority of their business was coming through like QuickBooks Online or something like that, right? Or TurboTax Online. And I think that's exactly why you've seen them make this pretty, pretty intense and dramatic shift to focus so much on, you know, what they're calling DevSecOps, around trying to work really closely with their web-based software that they're deploying and working on sort of real-time visibility on what attacks are happening there, specifically because, again, it's just a very, very different vector than how you would attack boxed-off-based software. So, you know, there's sort of this blanket terminology that people use around digital transformation, but like all of this is really coming back to, it's not just that sort of non-technology businesses are finding themselves in the, you know, software development world, and there's these sort of software companies that are, you know, now trying to deliver food services, but it's kind of any of these companies, whether or not it's a technology company or it's a food company or it's an auto company or it's a bank, like the way in which they're connecting with their consumers is through mobile web, like mobile applications and web applications. And it's just a different type of security than these folks have had to work on in the past.
Different how? I mean, I guess just because it is in that rapid deployment environment, you know, constantly evolving applications. Because that's the thing, man. Like there's always pressure for features, for changes from users. So there is a lot of code being, you know, changed.
Absolutely. So let's. There's two different examples here, right? So we can use the one example of the food service company. The food service company, like they've always had a CISO. They've had focused people focused on even digital security, but the security that they were focused on was really focused on securing the network of
exactly. Like let's lock down the desktops. Let's make sure no one can own our active, you know, our AD, like that sort of security. And then all of a sudden, it's like god, you know. And the website was a marketing site. Who cares, right? And now all of a sudden it's like, god damn it. You know, these are people are able to actually, you know, they're creating actions that are fiddling with pretty important databases. Like now we actually have to deal with that internet thing.
Exactly. And like, and again, I like using the example of Intuit because, you know, again, it's a great technology company. It always has been, but before when, if you're thinking about an attacker and you want to get access to somebody's like tax information or tax records, let's use like Signal Sciences, for example, because we use their technology. When we first started the company, we were running it on the computer. And so getting access to that data, they'd have to, you know, get into my endpoint, like try to crack into the software on my endpoint to be able to get that data. Now we transition over, we use their online system. And so if somebody were to crack into, you know, QuickBooks Online, not only could they get access to our specific information, but they could get access to everybody's information behind that. So like the attack scenario looks very different to the attacker, but the reward is so much better too.
Yeah, when you're aggregating all of that user that user data, right, and it's coming instead of being distributed amongst the clients and that being their risk, right? Because this is the thing, yeah. Right? It's you're sort of outsourcing the risk to your customers. It's like, well, you put it on your computer and securing your computer is your problem, right? All of a sudden, when you aggregate everyone's data, you put it online, okay, you're still serving the same function, but that risk register is going to look a little bit different when you're talking about product vulnerabilities.
Yeah. And so like when we end up having these conversations with the security folks that are working in these places, certainly they're trying to figure out, you know, how to get up to speed on some of the new ways to actually sort of secure those things. A couple of things have been really helpful for them. Number one, thinking about how they hire developers onto their team, because it really helps to kind of bridge that gap between a team that has historically maybe been more network focused than sort of software security focused. That bringing those people on really brings on really great skills and just kind of nomenclature to be able to start working with the dev teams really well. But the other thing that we've just kind of talked through this change is really like, look, if you're understanding that the investment from a business perspective is changing to be much more focused on, hey, we're going to develop and build a big software development team, then really talking about risk and risk exposure for those teams makes it so that the CISO can go and have that kind of conversation with the CIO and with the CTO or even with the board of these organizations saying, look,
this is a game changer.
So much success. Yeah, like we're having so much success in making these investments from a marketing and a business perspective. Like, hey, let's use this as an opportunity to get a lot more focus and raise these issues around this new area of security that's going to become a risk factor for us.
Because for every one of these examples that we're talking about, like this food delivery business, you know, there's, say, another firm which isn't even looking at security. They're just like, hey, look at this. Isn't this great? We've built this app and now all this stuff is coming in. Right. And that could be a problem down the track.
Yeah. I mean, it's, we've been in this business for a while now around sort of securing web apps and securing, websites. And I think, you know, as we continue to kind of see numbers come out every year where it's a really common place and the number one place where people are getting actually successfully breached. I think we're kind of sitting here and continue to scratch our heads of like, why is this not, why is more investment not going in this area, more focus not going in this area? And the answer is it is. Like people are making that change now and they're using this as the catalyst for really putting a new focus in the area.
People are spending the money. What an actual positive way to end this interview. Andrew Peterson, thank you very much for joining us on the show. It's always a pleasure to chat to you, my friend.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Patrick.
That was Andrew Peterson of Signal Sciences there. Always love a chat with AP. He is good people. And yeah, you can check out Signal Sciences at signalsciences.com. And that's it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.